and they work pretty well. But the efficiency varies. If you could give a few words about the efficiency versus the diameter and shape.
Let's first restrict ourselves to antennas in the half wavelength length or less, because once you start making an antenna 5/8 wave, 1 wave, 2 waves, 3 waves long, other things start happening. And you go to the antenna handbook, you'll find out that as the antenna becomes multiple wavelengths long, you develop a whole lot of lobes in space, and some of those lobes get very strong and they've got high gain, and you get notches in between them. So if we restrict ourselves to half wavelength antennas and shorter mechanically, now, if it's a dipole-like antenna and it's too short, it's going to be a strong capacitive reactance. Somewhere in the circuit, you're going to put an inductor to bring it back into resonance. That's if it's a dipole-like antenna. If it's a loop-like antenna and you made it too short, it's going to be highly inductive, and now you're going to add a capacitor somewhere in the circuit to bring into resonance. Once you take a half-wavelength antenna, and I don't care if it's a half-wave or smaller, quarter wave, eighth wave, 20th of a wave. When it's smaller than half wave, and you have forced it into electronic resonance at your operating frequency, if you're smart enough to choose the right materials, you will get 98% transmitting efficiency. You will get 98% receiving efficiency with that undersized antenna if you've used the right material. Let me warn you. What I've just told you, I believe to be the gospel truth. Not everyone's going to agree with that. It's a controversial area. You say those words on 20 meters today, and a high percentage of the people will say, what in the world? You're smoking. You're crazy. You go to the appropriate chapter. Let me drop. Arguably one of the best antenna books ever written by John Krause, W-A-J-K, from the Ohio Science Laboratory at Ohio University, at the electrical engineering department for a whole lot of years. He's now a silent key. But he wrote this very pivotal book in 1950 called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, and it's now in its third edition. You go to the appropriate chapter called The Infinitesimal Dipole, and if you know what you're reading, he will tell you as long as you've used low-loss materials and you've got it into resonance, you will get full efficiency out of an undersized antenna. The efficiency need not degrade. The effective capture area need not degrade. The receiving efficiency, the transmitting efficiency. If you've used the right materials, it's got to be the same. If you think it's inefficient, okay, how can it become inefficient? If I put 100 watts into the antenna, and I run a key down for 10 minutes, and then I turn off the transmitter, and I walk over there and touch everything, and if everything is ice cold, if it's not wasting my power into heat, how can it be inefficient? It's got to radiate it into space. It has too little real estate. Let me drop. An antenna with less than half wavelength of length, all the way down to zero in length, it becomes more and more difficult to resonate it. I'll admit that. It becomes higher and higher in Q and more narrowband. You QSY a little bit and you're going to have to retune it. Those are the disadvantages of being under inside. But you think it's inefficient. First of all, when it's that small, it can't have any significant antenna pattern. It doesn't have the real estate to do it. It's very close to an omnidirectional transmitter device, an omnidirectional receiving antenna. But if it's inefficient, and with 100 watts into it, it runs ice cold, which means less than a watt is being dissipated, what is it doing with that power? If it's not radiating it, and if it obeys the conservation of energy law, it's got to be radiating it. It's either sending it back to you as standing wave ratio, which means you haven't done a good enough job of impedance matching and resonating it, but once you do, you're not going to get BISWA. You're not going to get standing wave ratio. So if the power you send into it is not coming back, and if it's not being turned into heat, then what in the world is the mechanism of inefficiency? All the guys say that. It's got to be inefficient. And it's got to be small in capture area. Good common sense. Dead wrong. Not everyone's going to agree with that. It's going to take you a while to accept that. You're going to have to run a whole lot of experiments. You're going to have to read a whole lot of chapters in order to come to that conclusion. I'm reasonably sure if you spend the time, you will come to that conclusion. I'll know it's, I guarantee it's a tough one to accept at first. WS2N2XJM, K2LAW, go ahead, Wes.
NTXJM. And another question that I have is, putting into the strict bracket the capacitive character of the resonant circuit, that includes the antenna, and the inductive one. And I would like you to correct me in here, let me jump. You have a generator at X frequency, and your resonant circuit, that's your antenna, is just a little below the frequency of resonance of in reference to that signal. Now, you should have a capacitive character. Now, you don't change the frequency of the generator, but you increase the frequency of resonance of that resonant circuit. And now, that resonant circuit, that antenna, becomes a inductive in character. So, that's what I need correction with. And the second thing, whenever we have a capacitive character, we have a high voltage, low current. And whenever we have inductive one, we have a low voltage, high current. And to actually...
When most people build an antenna small, 90% of the time they build it in a dipole-like manner. They could, if they want to, build it as a resonant loop antenna. But very few people feel comfortable with loops. 90% of hams, when they build small antennas, it's a dipole-like structure. So let's talk about dipoles. Every dipole that's too small has a very high capacitive reactance. The Brown and Woodward curve will tell you that. The antenna becomes a capacitor as opposed to a 73-ohm resistor. You make it real small, the 73-ohm starts becoming small, it might go down to 1.5 ohms resistive component, and it might be 1,500 ohms of capacitive reactance. So 99% of what that antenna is a capacitor. Somewhere in that circuit, you're going to put an inductor to bring it back into resonance. Once you bring it back into resonance, it is now capable of resonating and radiating 98% of your power. Let me drop. By definition, every antenna that is undersized goes higher in Q. There are five definitions of Q. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Bandwidth divided into center frequency. Stored energy per cycle versus dissipated energy per cycle. Rise time and fall time. All of these, if you understand the mathematics of what's going on, they're really saying the exact same thing with different points of view. But the resonant energy is going to be higher and higher in stored energy versus radiated energy as you make the Q higher, as you make the antenna shorter. And as such, when you change your frequency a little bit, you're going to have to retune that antenna. It becomes more and more narrowband. By definition, let me drop. Since one of the definitions of Q is the voltage rise at resonance, if your antenna has a Q of 20, somewhere in that antenna, the voltage is 20 times higher than the voltage you launch to it on your transmission line. Simultaneously, somewhere in the antenna, the current is 20 times higher than the current your transmission line launched into it. Both go up on a dipole. They do it in the opposite manner with a loop. The loop that's too small becomes highly inductive, and you've got to put a great big capacitor somewhere to bring it back into resonance. But let's restrict our thinking to dipoles. All small dipoles are a capacitor. The voltage at the tip of that small dipole is going to get higher and higher as you make it smaller and smaller and force it back into resonance to radiate. And the only thing that stops you from going down to a zero size, let me drop. I mean, a guy who takes my words overly literally might say, gee, I don't want to make that dipole on 80 meters 132 feet long. I want to make it 1 inch long. Can you do that? And the answer is, in space, where the Apollo astronauts, the International Space Station astronauts operate, yes, you could do that. You try to do that on Earth. The voltage at the tip of that 1-inch dipole will be so high it will arc over in air. You'll be weighed beyond the point of the breakdown dielectric strength of air. Short of that, you can do it. You've got to be smarter and smarter in the materials you choose, because now there's more and more stored energy. Unless you've got very low resistance, very high performance materials, when you make that infinitesimal dipole, something's going to get hot. But there's ways around that. So the increase in Q is thoroughly predictable, and that is an increase in voltage and an increase in current by exactly that number. If the Q of your antenna is 20, somewhere in the antenna the voltage is 20 times higher, somewhere in the antenna the current is 20 times higher. That's the definition of Q. You can't have one without the other. Both current and voltage increase in different places in the antenna, but they've got to do it. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Thank you very much for that explanation. What I was expecting from you is just to give me a precise answer to my question. If the resonant frequency of an antenna is just a little lower than the frequency of the transmitter or generator, does the antenna have capacitive character? If the frequency of resonance of an antenna is a little higher than transmitter or generator frequency, does the antenna have the inductive character?
You've got the right idea, but you got it backwards. Every antenna that's too short, you could say the resonant frequency is high, and it will be a capacitor, dipole-like antenna. Every antenna that's a little bit too long is going to be tuned to a slightly lower frequency than you desire, and it will be inductor. So at half wavelength, you've got a pure resistor. Any antenna that is physically shorter than half wavelength has a dipole. It is a capacitor. Any antenna that's a little bit longer than half wavelength as a dipole is an inductor. The Brown and Woodward curve makes that very clear. When you look at the Brown and Woodward curve and you know what you're looking at, and there's two curves. One curve is for reactance, and one curve is for resistance. As you make it shorter, the resistive component gets lower and lower from 73 ohms. As you make it longer than half wave, the resistive component goes up. So by adjusting nothing but the length of the dipole, you can make the resistive component anywhere from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms, inclusive. Any number of resistors you want, the resistive component. Let me drop.
One thing. When you have a coil, and then you try to stretch the winds, you're decreasing the capacitive component of it. And then you make it resonate at higher frequencies. And then when you try to bring them closer, you're increasing the capacitive reactance of the coil, and then you make it resonating at lower frequencies. So I'm kind of confused in your explanation.
What you just said, Wes, is only partially true, and it's the secondary effect. If I've got an air-wound coil, and I measure its inductance, as I stretch it out, the first thing that happens is the inductance decreases. That's the primary factor of stretching an inductor. The number of microhenries or nanohenries goes down when you stretch it. And by the time you make it a completely flat-out piece of wire, and it's no longer a coil, it will have the lowest possible inductance. Yes, the capacitance between the individual turns is also going down as you stretch it. That's the second-order effect. It is not the primary effect. Squeezing and stretching a coil primarily changes the inductance first, changes the capacitance as a secondary effect. By the way, both are in the same direction. If the natural resonant frequency of my coil is, let me pick a number, 4 megahertz, and I start stretching it, the inductance goes down, the capacitance goes down between the turns, both make the resonant frequency go up. So you can easily think that it's all capacitance change, or you can easily think that it's all inductance change. It's primarily inductance change, and some of it is capacitance change. In both cases, the natural resonant frequency of the coil goes up when you stretch it, goes down when you crush it together. In 2XJN, K2LIW.
Beauty plan, sir. Okay. It's a beautiful answer. Yes, I agree with you. The longer the wire, the lower the frequency of the resonance. So, the longer the wire, then the capacitive character of it should be evident. No, it's kind of puzzling to area.
Now, the way you worded that, though, Wes, I think I know what you're saying, but you're going to confuse some people. You said the longer the wire, the lower the resonant frequency. Sort of true, but it's secondary. The longer wire wound into a coil means you've got more turns. With a rough approximation, the inductance of a coil is a function of the number of turns squared. You make your coil out of a longer length of wire, and you've decided on a particular diameter because you're winding it on a piece of PVC tubing. Your longer piece of wire, you're probably going to wind more turns. The more turns are where the inductance is coming from, because the inductance is somewhat equivalent to turns squared. As if the coil is compact enough so that all the magnetic field links all the turns. As you start stretching it out, you take this coil of wire that you wound on a piece of PVC tubing and you didn't glue it down yet, and you start stretching it out. Now all of the magnetic field is not linking all the turns, therefore this turns squared factor starts degrading, and so the primary factor of stretching out a coil that's on this piece of PVC tubing is the inductance goes down. The capacitance between the windings is a minor effect most of the time at secondary. The inductance going down because you stretch it out and all the magnetic field is not linking all the turns. I'm amazed that that section of many of the handbooks doesn't put it into a language that a lot of people get it. And so you've got to hear these statements multiple times. You've got to look at those graphs in the appropriate chapter on components, chapter 2 or 3, I think it is, in the Radio Amateur's Handbook. It'll give you a nomograph, where you go into the graph knowing the number of inches of diameter of the coil and the number of turns for a particular gauge of wire. It'll tell you how many microhenry you're going to get. And so from that you can get an impression. The guys who do real tinkering with antennas in a real laboratory a long time ago learned that stretching and shrinking coils decreases the inductance in that order. Stretching decreases the inductance. Compressing it increases the inductance. And guys learn that real fast, even though the books don't make it as clear as they should, in my opinion. But you got to hear it a few times before it makes some sense. You got to be doing a couple of antenna tunings in the backyard. And the nice thing about tuning an antenna in the backyard, let me drop, is that with rare exception, you're using inexpensive materials. Unless you do something really crazy, it's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire, it's not going to hurt anybody. As long as you've got a little bit of common sense as to how you use a bird watt meter or a standing wave ratio meter, as long as you know something about what you're trying to build, dipole, Yagi, ground plane, or whatever, after you've done some tinkering with lengths and look at what happens to the resonant frequency, every time you change the dimension of the antenna, you now sweep it. You set your transmitter at 3.5, 3.6, 3.7 megacycles. You go up the dial and you measure standing wave ratio at each one of those frequencies. And if everything is working right, you're going to get a bathtub-shaped curve, and the bottom of that bathtub is where you get the lowest possible standing wave ratio, is usually the half-wavelength length of the antenna, if it's a dipole-like antenna, at some reasonable length above the ground. And so once you've done some of that tinkering, change the length by maybe putting a clip lead on the end of the antenna. And now you've made this bathtub curve. You've got it plotted on a nice piece of paper. You put a clip lead at the end of the antenna, which means you've electronically made it a little bit longer, and you make the curve again. This time you use a red pencil instead of a black pencil, and now you see immediately what happens when you change the lens. And pretty soon, it becomes burned into your brain as to what you do. It's a little bit like when you drop... It's a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. His feet tells him which way the land is tilted, therefore he knows which way to walk to go uphill. You look at that bathtub curve, you look at the way it shifts as you make the wire longer or shorter, or zigzag it, or bring it closer to the ground, or further away from the ground. You plot those multiple curves with multiple colors of pencil, with the right kind of indication on the side of the graph as to what color it indicates what experiment you just ran, and all of a sudden this stuff makes a lot of sense, and it's not rocket science. And all of a sudden a lot of the mystery goes away. We amateurs are extremely good at antenna tinkering, and boy, you'd be amazed how many lessons that teaches. As it is right now, if you want a good radio engineer at your electronic company, particularly if you want a good antenna engineer, you have to hire a ham radio operator, because the schools do not teach it. The guy who tinkers in the backyard, he's got the knowledge. He's got the enthusiasm. It's burned into his brain as to what works, what doesn't work. He's got a whole lot of rules of thumb in his head. He knows which way to go to make it work better. He knows how to make the measurement to tell you, is it too high or too low in resonant frequency? Is it too long or too short? Is the radiating element too close to the ground plane? Is the tuning capacitor too big or too small? Is the coil that's doing the resonating too big or too small? Should he stretch it or shrink it? Because of his experience, because of his self-done apprenticeship, he's got that knowledge, that stuff's in his head, that's the guy you want to hire. KC2WGB, Keith Rise, I'll be climbing down off his soapbox. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Only one addition I think you should mention. In fact, that description you gave of the dipole getting smaller and smaller. Also, reciprocity continues, which is hard for a lot of people to believe. The receive area of that antenna is basically the same. Now, I don't know what measurements you would make to confirm that. I guess you would have to set up a couple of different samples, a few receivers, and see what the actual readings are. But that's tough for some people to believe, Dick.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. And there's two ways you can prove it to yourself. If you believe in reciprocity, you can measure the fact that when the antenna is transmitting, that's the easiest thing to measure, you can have two antennas side by side at the same altitude. Now, many guys have done this. One is a full half-wavelength dipole. The other one is a foreshortened dipole with a resonating structure on it. And they're both at the same altitude, both in the same direction. Very few of us can do all this. And now you talk to the same guy, or you talk to five different guys. Talk to a guy in London, talk to a guy in Chicago. And you say, this is the short antenna, this is the long antenna. They're both at the same altitude. Tell me what your S-meter says. Once you know that you can transmit with that antenna, the law of reciprocity says that any reasonable antenna, whatever property it has on transmission, gain, beam width, efficiency, side lobe level, front to back level, bandwidth, no matter what you measure on the antenna in the transmitting mode, the law of reciprocity says that antenna must have the exact same performance in the receive mode. To have that transmitting signal to get to that guy, you've got to have that transmitting area, electronic area. Or, when you flip back to the receive mode, you look at your S-meter, when you flip between the two antennas, you'll find out real fast. So, a real hard measurement, or making the gain measurement, and gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared, you can take that equation, rearrange it so that area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you know the gain of the antenna, and if you know the frequency you're operating at, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug it into that formula, and you know the area. You do that for a full half-wave dipole.
Repeater, timeout.
The area, let me drop. A full half-wave dipole at 80 meters, 132 feet long piece of 14-gauge wire, casts a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot. Its radio area is 8,500 square feet. Of course that sounds crazy. It's true. And you take that 132-foot long antenna on 80 meters, bring it down to 32 feet, and re-resonate it. It's got a much higher Q. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it will be within 4/10 of a dB. I hadn't done the mathematics, but I think it's going to be around 8,000. 8,500 down to 8,000, rough number. 90-some-odd% of the area is still there when you make it infinitesimal. The area of the antenna and the area of the wire are thoroughly unrelated. You can take that exact same antenna you built out of 14-gauge wire, and you build it out of 16-gauge wire. Instead of casting 1 square foot on the ground, you cast half a square foot on the ground. It still has 8,500 square feet of radio area. The physical thing your eye sees and what the radio wave sees because of resonance are almost unrelated to each other. In the case of half-wave-like and below dipole-like antennas, I will admit that when the case of a horn or a parabolic dish, in that particular case, the radio area and what your eye sees are very, very closely related. But that's not the way a dipole operates. It's a little bit similar to what happens when you're pushing your child on a swing. Let me drop. You've got a very light child on the end of the swing, and you're pushing with your finger, and after a few pushes, you bring the child up to a reasonable amount of swing magnitude. You move the very light child, and you put a very heavy person or two or three people on that swing, if the swing is strong enough to do it. By the way, changing the weight on the end of the swing does not change the resonant frequency. The resonant frequency is primarily a length of the pendulum, is the resonant frequency. So you put a very heavy object on the end of that swing. It swings at the exact same frequency, but now it's got much, much higher Q. You can still bring that heavy person up to the same amplitude, as long as you've got a good low loss bearing at the top of the swing, by pushing it with the exact same finger that you pushed the light child with, but now you're going to do it a hell of a lot more pulses of push before you bring them up to full amplitude. With the light child, maybe you did it with 5 pushes. With the heavy person on the swing, maybe it's going to take you 50 or 150 pushes to get them up to amplitude. That's what higher Q is. More stored energy per cycle versus dissipated per cycle. But once you bring them up to resonance, once you do enough of the pushes, you bring them up to the full resonance. That signal coming into your very short dipole, it has a higher, it's got a longer rise time, but you and I don't measure rise time of the antenna. The rise time of that 80-meter dipole is probably a couple of microseconds. That's an extremely brief period compared to the audio or the Morse code that you're sending down that antenna. Therefore, you never see the rise time. Let me drop. But that shorter dipole with that tuning element on it has a much higher Q. The much higher Q means that when you QSY, it's got a much more narrow bandwidth, you've got to retune it real fast. It also means that if you had the ability to measure the rise time, instead of being 1 microsecond, it may be 10 microseconds. But again, that's such a brief period of time compared to the audio or the Morse code you're sending, you'll never know the difference. High-speed data, maybe you'll see the difference. But so, once that rise time has taken place, which is the equivalent of you pushing your finger on that swing to bring that child, that heavy person, up to full amplitude, it still gets up to the full amplitude if you do it long enough. You could say the swing has got the exact same effective capture area. That antenna has got the exact same capture area. It captures the same amount of signal after you wait till that rise time is over with. And you and I never see that rise time because it's so darn brief. Another way of looking at it is that because the antenna, when you're transmitting, let me drop. Because the antenna, when you're transmitting, that's too small. It's got a very high Q. Let's say it's got a Q of 200. That means the current flowing somewhere in an antenna is 200 times higher than the current you launched into it with the transmission line. 200 times higher current means it's got 200 times stronger magnetic field. The stronger RF magnetic field is what sets off the real radiation process. So even though the length of the wire is shorter, the amount of area exposed to space is less. As the signal travels down that wire, it's got less opportunity to jump into space. A smaller percentage of it jumps into space on each bounce. It's now going to make 200 bounces instead of 20 bounces before that signal all gets radiated. The higher Q current, the higher magnetic field of that shorter length of wire allows it to still radiate all that power. And whether you're talking about the effect on transmit, which is easier to see in your brain, as opposed to receive, on receive it does the same thing. The area is there. If it's got the gain on transmit, it's got to have it on reception. Otherwise, you're violating reciprocity. And you don't violate reciprocity with an antenna unless you put something nonlinear in there, like an amplifier or a circulator. As long as it's real reactive, resistive components, real, what's the word for it now? regular components in the antenna, it will obey reciprocity. Antennas don't violate reciprocity. Antennas don't violate conservation of energy. If all the transmitting power you put into that antenna, even though it's too short, if it doesn't get hot, and if it doesn't get reflected back to you because you've adjusted the VIS lock correctly, it's got no choice but to radiate it. And short antennas have got a quasi-omnidirectional pattern. You don't have enough real estate to set up a great big lobe in one direction and have a real front-to-back...
Repeater, time out.
W-A-2-S-A-Y.
Doug recognized you don't have the real estate to make a real antenna pattern. So it's very close to omnidirectional. So if you plotted the antenna pattern of a full half-wave dipole at 132 feet, and then you make your infinitesimal dipole at 80 meters, which is only 32 feet long, and you plot that antenna pattern, and you lay them on top of each other, except for 4/10 of a dB at the broadside, there would be no difference. And that 4/10 of a dB is not loss. It's a change in antenna pattern because your donut got a little bit fatter. But it's still very close to an omnidirectional pattern because you don't have the real estate to do anything else. I know this is controversial. I know the first time you hear it, you're going to say this is crazy. And as I said, if I did a survey on 20 meters right now, 95% of the people would say, don't listen to this guy, he's off the wall. W-A-2-S-A-Y, he's still listening, I don't know why. K-2-R-A-W, you got it, Doug.
That's W-A-2-S-A-Y here. I think there's at least in my mind, there's a bit of a misunderstanding here. You take a full half-wave dipole, and it's got 2.13 dB gain over an isotropic radiator. You take an isotropic radiator, by definition, it has 0 dB gain. So as you shrink your half-wave antenna down to something approaching an isotropic radiator, you lose not 4/10 of a dB, but 2.1 or almost 2.1 dB of gain. Is that not correct?
Good common sense, Doug. And by the way, even if you lost 2.14 dB, percentage-wise, that ain't bad. You're still on the air. That's not an antenna that's 40 dB down, if you know what I mean. Even if you lost all of the 2.14, 2.13 dB, it's not bad. However, I'm saying it's almost an omnidirectional antenna. It's a very fat dipole-like pattern, very fat donut. But every small dipole, every real dipole, has a null off the ends of the wire. It can't be isotropic. That null off the end of the wire means that a whole lot of spatial three-dimensional degrees off the end of the wire, you're not radiating any signal in that direction. Let me drop.
DC2QIQ with two comments.
Glenn recognized. There's a whole lot of degrees of space off the ends of the wire where you're radiating no signal. You got no place left to radiate it except the broadside. The full half-wave dipole is 2.14 dB of gain. If I subtract 4/10 from that, I get 1.74 dB. An infinitesimal dipole has 1.74 dB of gain, 4/10 of a dB lower than the 2.14 that you get when it's full half-wave. It's moving in the direction of isotropic. That's as far as it can go because it can't radiate off the ends. So I'm using words a little bit too strongly when I say it's almost isotropic. It's 1.74 dB above isotropic. That ain't very far. And by the way, let me drop another one other point I'm going to say here before I go over to Glenn. There's a hell of a lot of small antennas out there that you can buy for your compact VHF, UHF device, whether you're putting antennas on there for 902 to 928 megacycles, the so-called license-free band at 900 megs, or the other license-free band at 2.4 gigs, 802.11 type frequencies, there's a hell of a lot of small antennas you can buy where a dirty little secret is that the gain of that antenna, in many cases, is set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory, for a very good reason. There's a hell of a lot of people out there who only partially understand antennas, and they're trying to get the biggest bang for the dollar. They want to get the highest number of dB per dollar of the antenna. Let me drop. The real antenna may have a gain of 1.0 dB over isotropic because of its inefficiency. 1.0 over isotropic. They will advertise it as 2.0 over isotropic because it sounds twice as good. 2 dB sounds twice as good as 1 dB over isotropic. Because decibels are a logarithmic function, they really differ by, I think, one is 85% or 90% of the other, if you know what I mean. There's really very little difference. So from the, as far as the ethics is concerned, the advertising department says, hey, we're only lying by 15% when we call it 2 dB of gain instead of 1 dB of gain, but we'll double our sales when we do it because the antenna sounds twice as good. So when you get down to 1.74 dB of gain over isotropic as an infinitesimal dipole compared to a full dipole of 2.14, that's a very small, that's almost the width of the needle on your signal strength meter on your receiver, if you could measure it accurately, if you know what I mean. We're splitting hairs here. KC2WGB, I mean, here we go. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Good evening, Dick. I know I've made a lot of these measurements myself, and I've basically proved them out to what you're saying is true, except there's a couple of things that I'm not sure, maybe you can expand on a little bit. In other words, I know that if I take my full-length dipole and I'm running it at least 2 to 3 wavelengths above the ground, and you can imagine at 80 meters, that's not a simple task. But certainly at VHF and UHF, you can prove this out pretty quickly. That's certainly 2 to 3 wavelengths off the ground. Whether you have the full half-wavelength antenna or the shortened dipole, much of the effects that you're talking about certainly are, you know, definitely right on the money. But the problem is with 80 meters, and or any antenna for that matter, when you're less than a couple of wavelengths off the ground, what starts happening with these shortened antennas are that the radio horizon of the antenna tends to point straight up. I don't know if you have any more words to add to that. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
To really do that experiment, Glenn, very few of us have got the resources to take the infinitesimal dipole and the full-wave dipole, full half-wave dipole, and set both of them at the exact same altitude at some reasonable spacing where they're not coupled to each other, end-to-end, so to speak, and hopefully there aren't any other local perturbations like a water tower nearby that reflects more off one antenna than the other, so to speak, or a building or your house. So to have two antennas end-to-end to each other, not coupled to each other, both the exact same altitude off the ground, and you, with a short enough period of time, you flip back and forth between them and talk to enough guys, your buddy in London, your buddy in Ohio, and you try to make a judgment as to the takeoff angle. Is there really a difference? It is most likely, let me drop.
I have some serious answers for that one, Dick, because I've done these measurements.
In theory, that either one of those antennas, when you're far enough away from it, is it a close to a point source radiation? You could assume that all the radiation is coming from one point in space. And if they're both at the exact same altitude, that point in space is almost the same place. Now, because 80 meters is such a darn big wavelength, because the antenna is so close to the ground in wavelength in many cases, because the higher Q of the smaller antenna has a much stronger magnetic field, and because that magnetic field is coupling into that resistive, that volumetric resistive material in your backyard called dirt, could there be a greater amount of loss because of the stronger local magnetic field of the shorter dipole? I think you could make a case for that. But would it really change the takeoff angle? Is one antenna, I mean, most of the good books will say this number of wavelengths off the ground will have that number of angle of takeoff. and they usually don't have another paragraph there saying only if it's half wavelength long, and it doesn't hold if the antenna is only a quarter wavelength long. I've never seen that kind of a statement. So tell me what you've observed. Did the two antennas sit end-to-end at exactly the same altitude, and within a short period of time where there wasn't QSB, did you really see a difference in either transmit or receive? And now you've got another problem there, and that is the reciprocity. In other words, let me drop. Faraday rotation is such that when you transmit horizontal, the guy in London may get it vertical. When he transmits vertical back to you, you think you're going to get horizontal? Uh-uh. You might get vertical. In other words, the one thing that violates reciprocity is the Faraday rotation. You mix the magnetic field with a ionosphere, and the signal twists at one rate when it's going from east to west, and it twists at a different rate when it's going from west to east. So when you try to go back and forth between transmit and receive, and you're doing these comparisons, boy, there's a lot of ways you can be led astray on this one. So tell me what you observed, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I started actually measuring, seeing these effects, and this is going back about 3-4 years ago now, and I know when these discussions first started, and I noticed I was having tremendous problems with horizontal polarization and trying to come up with some answers to this, and here's the approach that I took. The first effect was I wanted to go with much higher frequency so that the antennas were shorter in length so that I could get on bands where I could actually handle these and do some field measurements. And I went into some areas where I had parks that had open area fields. Let me let it drop. And I started first with HTs, and I had HTs that were basically working on 2 meters and 440. More recently now I've been verifying these also on 900 megahertz, and the result is exactly the same. And I have whips that attach to these HTs that are half-wave and quarter-wave length, and I've even experimented with some other antennas that I'm not going to even bring into this conversation. But what I did find was that when I stand on the ground at just one human height off of the ground in an open field, I can hit repeaters in the open field and everything else. If I sit down on the ground and hold the same HT in the same open field, I almost have one-half or worse the ability to, in reciprocity, receive and transmit. If I lie on the ground, in other words, just hold the HT right at ground with the vertical width standing straight up, it's hard and difficult to make communications just beyond the open field that I'm in, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Well, I've got absolutely no problem with that one, Glenn. If I'm listening to a very far-off repeater, and I'm standing in the middle of a schoolyard, great big flat open field, and all the schoolyards are that flat. Our local schoolyard's got quite a few hills to it. But as you bring that handy-talky down lower, as we've all known, on VHF frequencies, the gain of the antenna is secondary to altitude. You've heard me say so often, the three things that make a good VHF, UHF antenna work well are altitude, altitude, altitude. And so as you take that VHF whip antenna on your handy-talky and you bring that whole handy-talky close to the ground, you're really making a whole bunch of vertically displaced fingers in space. I'm calling them fingers. That's really a whole bunch of beaver tails, flat beaver tails in space. And as you raise and lower that handy-talky, those beaver tails are moving up and down. Higher handy-talky, the beaver tails move down. Lower handy-talky, the beaver tails move up. So that lowest beaver tail is the one on the horizon. And if it's not enough of that signal going to that repeater, he's not going to hear you. So in the case of VHF, is it really ground reflection? Is it takeoff angle? Is it attenuation? Let me drop.
I have part two to the stick.
Is it the attenuation of the trees? Is it the blockage of the buildings? There's a hell of a lot of things going on at VHF. And so for you and I at VHF frequencies with a handy-talky to truly measure takeoff elevation angle, we can do it, but you've got to be pretty heroic. To simply say the repeater is hearing me better or not, and therefore I've moved the takeoff angle this way with a 5/8 wave whip on my handy turkey versus a quarter wave whip on the handy turkey, there's a lot of things changing there at once. So it's kind of hard to make a judgment of takeoff angle versus length of antenna versus altitude on that VHF frequency with a handy turkey. On top of that, the real counterpoise for that handy turkey is not necessarily the box that it's contained in. That hand wrapped around it and that arm and the rest of the human being is the rest of the counterpoise. There's a lot more going on here. KC2 QIQ, K2LIW.
Right on. And that's exactly where I'm going right now. So the next part two of the experiment was, since I started seeing that effect, I wanted to find out, why is that? So I took basically my HT, and I took another transceiver that had a battery, and I ran a feed line cable to make sure that I was far enough away from the near field of that antenna that I ran 50 feet of coax, and I took a plate that I was originally using for Doppler and other things, and I made a plate that was roughly about 36 inch square, and I put my mount for the antenna on the center of this plate and put it on ground level, and I started making measurements for quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave. And certainly on the ground level, the quarter wave had very poor performance. The half wave had fairly decent, and oddly enough, the 5/8 almost sounded as good as if I had the HT standing up at full height. Then I decided to start raising the plate off of the ground, and then coming from ground level, from 50 feet away, and just moving it up, you know, one wavelength off the ground, two wavelengths, and eventually I decided to take two ladders and put them side by side, stood out in the same field, and Dick, just going up three wavelengths, it was remarkable, the difference. And as I said, the most interesting part was the longer the wavelength of the antenna, the more critical and the more sharp the problem was. So let me let this drop for a second.
What about the counterpoise? Have you been your radio at that height?
Okay, to continue. So what I did was, now I went to the next step, because I was basically running out of time here, running these experiments. There was lifting the antenna from ground and then coming up. But certainly the length of the antenna became more and more aggressive the closer and closer I was getting to ground. But then what I found out was that from somewhere like above three wavelengths, when you start getting to roof level, if I started mounting the same antennas 20 feet, 50 feet, 70 feet up in the air, the amount of difference between the antennas was almost completely negligible, Dick. You couldn't even tell the difference between the antennas. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I'm fairly sure that if we did a continuous curve, in other words, if I built some kind of an elevator mechanism on the side of my radio tower so that I could take your 1 yard square metal plate with various antennas on it, and now by turning the crank, that elevator moves that antenna up the tower so I now get a continuous plot of signal strength versus altitude. That would be a very interesting curve. And, of course, you're going to find that once you get the right number of wavelengths above the ground, you clear the local trees and buildings and whatever. You get a tremendous increase in signal strength from ground level up to that point. Another thing going on here, Glenn, is that when I take a 1 yard ground plane at 2 meters or 450, almost doesn't matter what you did it on, and if I now compare quarter wave, 5/8 wave, half wave antennas, the takeoff angle of that monopole on that sheet of metal is a significant difference in the elevation pattern of those three antennas on that sheet of metal in free space. If you were really doing this with an infinitesimal dipole fed with the right kind of a balancing device, that factor would be removed. Because the nice thing about a real symmetrically fed, let me drop.
If there's a part three, if you're interested in that as well.
In a symmetrically fed dipole with the right kind of a balancing device, it always radiates the strongest signal broadside to the wire. So there isn't an elevation pattern built in, three different elevation patterns built into the basic antenna in free space. So you, with that ground plane experiment, you had that factor aggravating some of what you're trying to measure. So I think you're saying now you went to a real half-wave dipole or a less than half-wave dipole, but a real symmetric dipole with what you believe to be a good balance. And let me warn you now, and that is, as the dipole gets smaller and smaller, and the Q gets higher and higher, your ability to make a really balanced balancing device becomes more and more difficult. You can easily, locally, magnetic field start saturating that balance, the ferrite of it. If it wasn't being fed with 72-ohm twin leads, so to speak, it becomes another set of measurement difficulties. I didn't say you didn't do it right. I'm just telling you what the degree of difficulty is. Tell me what the next step was, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
The next step was to take a piece of PVC pipe, and what I did was I precision drilled the PVC pipe to a half-wave antenna on 70 centimeters, a half-wave length on 2 meters. I made two different antennas, the perfect half-wave dipoles, fed them with coaxial cable, and just basically ran the coaxial cable out. Then eventually I did go back and make a balun for it, but it didn't really seem like a one-to-one, and it really didn't make much of a difference. Then what I did was I took, basically went to 8 wavelength dipoles, and for the same two bands, and basically did the same, just drilled the PVC holes, attached the wire, made my little balun on the other side, made sure with my MFJ matching device at 50 feet away, I had a very, very good match with my little baluning circuit and a little tuning capacitor, and I got these things like matched near one-to-one as good as you could get. And you know what the funny part was, Dick? I recreated the same measurements between what was my simulated, quarter-wave dipole to the half-wave dipole, and basically took the same measurements near ground, moved it up a little bit, about 3 wavelengths off the ground, and then tried roof-mounting the antennas, and it had exactly the same effect, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. All vertical polarization, by the way.
You had a very small dipole. How did you make that balun, Glenn? That's a very difficult thing to do. I think you said you were using 50 feet of coax, and you had an antenna tuner. But I'm a little bit worried that the antenna tuner was on the transmitting end of that coax, not on the antenna end. So as the antenna gets smaller and smaller, if you did that experiment and the Q gets higher and higher, the insertion loss of the coax has to be going up if the antenna tuning is not taking place right at the antenna. So location of the antenna tuner, location of the balun, and what was the balun? To make a ferrite balun on an infinitesimal dipole is a very difficult thing to do without saturating it, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ, KQLIW, if you're feeding with coax.
Well, my balun was kind of an interesting little structure. What it was created with was basically using coaxial quarter wavelengths. So in other words, I was making transformer step-ups with coaxial cable. Very, very similar to like doing, 2-to-1, 4-to-1 type of impedance transforms with quarter wavelengths. And that's basically the impedance match. And then what I had to do was just a little bit of a capacitor on the end just to trim it to make it perfect right at the dipole itself. So basically that was how I was making the matchstick, was making transformers with coaxial cable.
Can you give me a couple words on how you did that? I mean, one way to do it would be a so-called half-wave coax balun. Unfortunately, that's a 4-to-1 step-up impedance, and that's the wrong direction. As your dipole becomes very short, the resistive component becomes very small.
4-to-1 switch stick. Go the other way.
Okay. If I go the other way, you got to give me some words as to what that means. The dipole has become short. The resistive component...
On the transformer, Dick. Can you let me speak for a second?
Go ahead.
If you make it transformer 4-to-1 and you flip it around the other way, it's 1-to-4. So it just depends on how you connect it.
Well done. So it's a half-wave coax balun fed where the normal two output connectors are your 50-ohm transmission line input, one shielded and one the center conductor. And now that's not using that balun in the intended manner as a balun. The balanced side is supposed to have a balanced transmission line, and you put an unbalanced transmission line on the so-called balanced side. So it's not a... Maybe a good enough, but it's not an ideal balun, Glenn. Go ahead.
No, I wouldn't say it was a perfectly balanced balun on the... That was the transformation. First, I had to get the transformation. Once I got the impedance correct to the cable, then what I did was I basically just took the coax at the end of the... I had like a little step-off boom for this piece. piece of PVC, which was another piece of PVC, and I ran basically the coaxial cable and kind of like looped it around a couple of times and then put a piece of ferrite around the outside of the coaxial cable.
Okay, I think you're saying you use this balloning device plus the so-called poor man's balloon, multiple turns of coax, and on 2 meters, that's sort of doable. On 432 with RG8, that's kind of difficult, Glenn. Go ahead.
I got to send you pictures. It wasn't actually that difficult. And it wasn't RG8. I was using, like, the 58 coax. And there was, as I said, because this is all just, you know, experimentation. This is not, like, permanent bound stuff. And I used very, very, the thinnest diameter stuff I could get away with and still get them and collect the data. But what was interesting is that when you looked at the half wave versus the eighth wave, the higher in altitude those two antennas got, I guess the whole crux of this is when you come down to it, what I saw in data was that as the antennas got higher, the difference in the capture areas and what they were, those antennas, how they operated was almost identical as they went up in altitude. But once you get down to somewhere like a few wavelengths off of ground, they radically go off in different directions. The shorter antenna, it becomes almost, it's like death and almost a dummy load when it gets very, very close to ground. And so it seems that the longer antenna certainly has an advantage. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Interesting. One good set of measurements. So from that you conclude that when the antenna is short, something happens between it and Earth that raises the elevation angle faster on the short antenna than the long antenna. Is that what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
I don't have absolute proof of that, Dick, right now, but it appears that that's what's happening. There's a similar effect when you go horizontal, but the variables were just too different, and I don't have enough to give you a real conclusion. But I would suggest so far that the data that I've collected is pushing me in that direction, but I wouldn't say it for sure. But I can say that certainly, at low altitude, I think you do have a strong advantage with a longer antenna. If you're going to, in other words, if you have something where you can string that antenna up at 80 feet, I don't think it's going to make, you could probably tune a tuna fish can up there, and I think it's going to work. K2RW, K2QIQ.
Tuna fish can up there. Okay. And as I've been saying, is that any piece of metal, if you're smart enough, can be made into an antenna. I know we got pretty far off center on this one, John, but lots and lots of people want to really know about these antennas they can squeeze into their environment and how much of it's...
Could you say something about, let's say, multiple times of the wavelength, 10 times, 20 times?
No.
Okay.
And the reason for that is I have no experience there. The only place I've got experience in that case is to look in the antenna handbook. It has a whole bunch of diagrams that shows you what happens when the antenna is 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 wavelengths long. You develop a whole lot of lobes in space, and some of those lobes are higher in gain, and there's great big notches in between. It's a whole bunch of fingers in space when you plot it as an XY plot. If you make a three-dimensional plot, it's really a whole bunch of cones in space. But I've got no direct experience there. But I believe it. In other words, those antenna patterns that they plot, I believe them. And you're using those antenna patterns when you build a rhombic antenna. Each one of the four sides of the rhombic antenna are multiple wavelengths long. Each one of those pieces of wire that are multiple wavelengths long are making a antenna pattern that are those cones in space when you look at it three-dimensionally. And if you set up the angles just right on your rhombic antenna, the cones of the lower half of the diamond and the cones of the upper half of the diamond, so to speak, all line up with each other. And therefore, you end up with a pretty nice forward lobe and a couple of other lobes on a rhombic antenna. The most experienced, the most enthusiastic experiment along these lines, let me drop. I think the guy's call letters were VK3ATN, but I'm not positive on that. But what he did, he's got a whole lot of acres of open farmland, so to speak, in Australia, and he set up a